This is the Cloud Ace Podcast, bringing you the latest in cloud security through captivating chats with fascinating cybersecurity experts who are leaving their mark on the industry. Cloud Ace is brought to you by SANS Institute and hosted by SANS certified instructor, Brandon Evans. And now, prepare for departure. We are cleared for takeoff. Here's your captain, Brandon Evans.
Today, I'm joined by Stacy Dunn. Most people break into security by pivoting from another IT role, but Stacy has a really interesting and unconventional career path. After graduating with a fine arts degree, she made a pivot into IT by studying management information systems. During her time studying that, she started her career as an information security analyst for a financial institution. Afterwards, she worked for Checkpoint and Sneak as a security engineer and solutions engineers, respectively. Today, she is a senior solutions engineer for SANS, matching organizations with the educational resources that meet their specific needs. A self-described huge nerd, Stacy is also a co-host of the CISO Dojo podcast, co-leader of her local OWASP chapter, and owner of a nonprofit video game art show. I have no idea what that is, but it sounds right up my alley. So I'm looking forward to discuss that and more in this episode. Welcome, Stacy.
Hey, how are you doing today? That was the most succinct version of my own backstory that anyone has ever given. So thank you for that. I might even steal that from you.
Happily, I'll send that to you. Absolutely. So a lot of people come from very different backgrounds that, you know, take turns all over the place. And you mentioned in your LinkedIn profile that in addition to using the left brain skills that we typically see in this field, you also take a right brain approach when it comes to troubleshooting, solving complex problems, and improvising. So just curious, because I'm also kind of in that boat, are you ambidextrous?
No. I am right-handed. However, From childhood, everyone, whenever they see me write, they say, you write backwards. You write like a left-handed person does. I also count money backward, and I use my left hand to do a lot of different things, but I can't write with it in the same way that I can with my right hand. So the short answer is no, but the long answer is it's all kinds of mixed up mumbo jumbo when it comes to like how I operate and do things.
Absolutely. And I can relate. I'm kind of ambidextrous in that both sides of my body are equally terrible. Thank goodness I don't have to have good handwriting in order to use a computer, or else it would be really, really embarrassing. So I think a lot of people think that cloud, AppSec, and security writ large are hard sciences, and I really couldn't disagree more. Creativity is so much more important in the things that we do, in my view. Code is art to me. So what are some of the common mistakes that left brain folks miss when it comes to solving problems in cybersecurity?
It's going to be kind of a long answer, but to make it as direct as possible, I think you're really hitting it on the nose. I don't believe that everything is so binary. I don't believe that when it comes to even code or computers in general, that it has to be this cold, hard technological thing. In fact, if we see computers or all of these different avenues as innovators, they have to be led by creativity. There's always that human element and that human component that exists within inside of them, regardless of what the function is. So whenever it comes down to that, I think some of the best, pieces of technology are due to creativity.
Absolutely. I mean, code is just a way of assembling the recipe, but you have to be creative in order to know what you want to create in the first place. And people can write code that technically works, that is incredibly poorly structured. It's really not as simple as people make it out to be, in my view. What do you think?
No, I completely agree with that too. I think when it comes to coding, there are a lot of people that have differing opinions about it. But I think the more that we add that creative flair, or the more that we try new or different things, the better something becomes. Because if we try to stay in this sort of rigidity that I think a lot of people try to adopt, or the sort of, well, it's a computer, it doesn't need to have these other elements, we're just not going to get anywhere.
Absolutely. And creativity is good in my view, but also can be dangerous. I work with a lot of developers that have creative solutions. And one of my favorite quotes is that creative code leads to creative bugs. And that's often true in the world of security as well, right? If you try to do something that's creative, another word for that could be hacky, it could result in your code getting hacked. So it's definitely a balance for sure. And that's part of the reason why the software development lifecycle is so important. And I know that you work heavily in that space, trying to really do the impossible task of bridging the gaps between security and developers. So as a security-minded developer, even I make mistakes when I try to build things quickly. So what have you tried in that area and what has been successful for you?
So I wouldn't necessarily call myself a developer. I've worked alongside developers and acted as a champion. I, you know, came from the more artistic side and then went into security. And whenever I went through that process, I kind of came to a lot of different realizations. So when I see developers in security, I see them as two things that shouldn't be separate, but they often are. So whenever it comes down to it and what's, you know, what works the best is being able for security teams to give their developers that responsibility of security and allowing them to integrate it in the tools that they're already using. So whenever they have a tool and they want to do something securely, it has to be something that they're likely accustomed to, something that can keep them agile still while also providing that extra layer of security. I hope that answered the question.
It definitely does. And I think that everybody says DevSecOps, you know, integrate operations into development, integrate security into DevOps. And I generally agree. But as of late, I've just been feeling a little pessimistic about that because people already have enough hard work to do as a developer. How do you convince developers that security is cool or worth caring about?
I think if you think of it from the perspective of how much time are you spending doing additional cycles or sprints fixing a problem that happened in production? So if you can kind of quantify it and bring it to a point where it says, hey, if you do something right the first time and it's the most secure and you bake that into your process, you're going to spend less time fixing things because that's what a lot of people don't like to do. They don't like to spend their time reworking and doing things that they've already done before. They want to be working on something that's different or challenging, not constantly just adding on top of what they've done.
Absolutely. And I think that really is illustrated by the fact that some studies show that the cost of remediating a bug in production is, I believe, 100 times versus if you can solve that same problem in the design phase. So that's definitely a huge part of it. But I also think at the same time, it really comes down to managers actually investing in that area, because to your point, if individuals have to fix security bugs, they would prefer to fix them before they show up into production. But that assumes that management is actually telling them to fix those security bugs.
Yes. That is an assumption. And I would like to add to the point of what you're saying. So security has to exist as a culture that is at the core of an organization. And the managers do have to have that buy-in as well. So if they don't have that, and if they also don't have the buy-in of continuously training developers and investing in them and the tools that they're using, it becomes a much harder and bumpier road.
Absolutely. And a big part of that, I think, is tooling, because at the end of the day, developers, some of them are going to be interested in security and investing in them is really important. But I think, in my view, I've just interacted with a lot of folks. And at this point, I've just really, surrendered to the fact that a lot of developers just don't care or don't want to learn these things. And that's not how I am. I really enjoyed learning security when I was a developer, but some people are just different. What have you noticed when it comes to developer training specifically?
I think whenever it comes to developer training, it really depends on the delivery and it depends on whether or not it's quote unquote mandatory, right? So there's different ways you can go about it. If it's something that the developer is already interested in, or if it's something that they could be kind of pulled into due to an adjacent interest, it's something that's a little bit better. But I often see when it comes to security, there's kind of, again, I mentioned siloed or this walled approach of it's mandatory or, you know, if you don't do this or if you don't do XYZ, then you're in trouble. And I think that whenever you add punitive measures to anything, that really makes people back off of it even more. And it kind of makes them double down. And they're like, well, I didn't want that to start with. And now I don't want it even more. So meh.
Yeah, that could be really tricky, the carrot versus stick method. And I think the bigger part is if you really punish people for doing the wrong thing and then they learn not to do the wrong thing, how much longer are they going to even stay within that organization? Now you've taught them how to do the right thing and they're just so frustrated with the situation that they don't want to deal with it anymore.
Yeah. And that also speaks to what I was saying about culture, because, you know, if we go back to our original conversation and what we were talking about that human element and talking about creativity, I think when it comes to management, when it, you know, and any role, but this is pretty specific to a lot of technical roles, there are a lot of managers that, you know, maybe don't know how to manage people. They don't know how to handle conflicts. And they do tend to attach those more punitive measures as opposed to an improvement sort of approach. So if you're being, I don't know, yelled at or you feel like you can't make mistakes, then that's not a great place to be either. And you're right. If that's the case, people will tend to kind of move out of organizations or roles like that.
Absolutely. And I feel like in general, people hop around very quickly. We don't want to give them more reasons to hop around than they already have. And, you know, both of us have hopped around a couple organizations at this point. You've worked with Checkpoint, you've worked with Sneak, and you've seen a lot of different organizations that work with those tools. Checkpoint alone basically does everything under the sun. And as a result, you're working with a lot of organizations that have been on-prem or they're in the cloud now. Maybe they've started their journey. Maybe they've finished their journey. And I feel like a lot of those folks fail to properly translate the techniques that they learn on-prem to cloud technologies. So I'm curious, what are some of the key differences in your mind between working on-prem versus in the cloud? And what are also the similarities?
I think you spoke to something that I definitely noticed in my time there. So when it comes to people approaching the cloud, often what they will do is they won't treat it that much like it's on-prem. Sure, there are differences, but when you really think about it, it's a couple of layers removed from, like, let's say the OSI model, for example. As someone that was kind of learning networking from a backwards perspective of learning security and networking together, and then also learning cloud before on-prem, whenever I was in my first cloud security course and I was learning about it, it just made sense to me from just the networking perspective, because everything was kind of laid out in front of me and you could easily peer or, you know, use something like a transit gateway to make those connections. So whenever it comes to the actual networking and security pieces, they're essentially the same things. If we talk about Checkpoint specifically, you know, whenever you have a security gateway that is in the cloud, it's the same exact code as one of the gateways on one of their hardware devices. It's just existing in, you know, maybe a different type of endpoint, for example. So as far as those differences go, it's not that different, but it also is. It has its nuances, it has its complexities. And in terms of what people should do, is they should treat it the same when it comes to security. Security should be foundational. The most common mistake I would see personally is people not doing that and then kind of acting like security is this bolt-on thing that they could add at a later time, which didn't turn out that great for a lot of organizations, I'll say that.
Yeah, everybody just wants to have that box that you check that says add security. And there's only one tool that I know that has that capability, and that's Jenkins. And believe it or not, if you go into Jenkins in the settings, there's literally a box that says add security or something like that. It's wow. Really, really weird and really embarrassing. But yeah, networking is largely the same, I would agree, within the cloud. But then you have things like identity and access management. And I feel like people just really don't seem to understand how the network alone is not going to protect your cloud environments. So what's your perspective? How well do people transition? I know you said that you started off in the cloud, and I'm very much the same way. But in terms of working with organizations that haven't done that, where do you think the disconnect is?
I think you're also hitting it on the nose there too when it comes to the IAM roles and provisioning things, because what I tend to see is that a lot of people don't understand the shared responsibility model. You know, it's like whether it's the security of the cloud or what's in the cloud. Now you, if you have, you know, anything infrastructure as a service in the cloud, you're responsible for the same things that you would be on-prem in terms of like, are these things up to date? Do I have the necessary security components? And whenever I see organizations do this and they're, you know, transitioning into the cloud for whatever reason, what I typically like to do is ask them, you know, why are you moving into the cloud? What purpose, you know, are you doing this for? Is it for reliability? Is it for scalability? You know, we try to figure out those different reasons. And then you have to do it from the same approach of, are you doing that basic governance and compliance? Are you also doing your application and infrastructure controls? Is there policy? Is there logging and monitoring? Are you doing risk assessments, risk management, things like that? The answer is sometimes yes, but a lot of the time, no. So that's kind of what I've seen where people will just kind of stand something up and then just expect it to be safe. And that's not really the case.
So funny question about that. You know, you ask that question. I think it's a great question. Why are you trying to go to the cloud in the first place? What is the worst answer you've heard to that question? I'm really curious.
Oh, it's more of, I won't say it's a direct answer, but I will do kind of an amorphous blob answer of other people kind of saying the same thing. And it was essentially, well, that's what everyone else is doing. That's what's popular. And it's like, well, if you don't really have a fundamental reason to do it, if you're not trying to, I don't know, like do, if someone has a website and they want to manage their bandwidth by doing automatic load balancing or something, you know, like that might be a good reason, or accessibility for development, or, you know, uncoupling a monolithic application and turning it into microservices and using that as a platform to do so. Those are good answers. But just because everyone else is, that's not a good answer.
That really pains me to hear that people are actually saying, oh, we're doing it because everybody else is doing it. That really makes me wonder what other technologies are they adopting for that same reason. I feel like a lot of people are all about Kubernetes just because everybody's all into Kubernetes. You've seen that as well?
Yeah. I have seen so many circumstances where they're like, we need Kubernetes and we need it now. It's like, but why? And they're like, I don't know. It's like, are you even really using any containers? No. What? Where did you get this idea? There's a lot of that. And I think what that usually tends to happen, or why that tends to happen, is because there might be someone within a managerial role or a C-suite role that reads or hears about something, and they might be more on the business side than the technical side. And they see all these different innovations happening and they might feel behind. I don't really know. This is conjecture a little, but that's my guess at the very least.
Yeah, I've definitely seen that before, where people are just trying to do the next thing where it's completely unnecessary. I'm definitely going to have to add this to the show notes just because it's one of my favorite articles of all time. But there's this article that's called, I think it's like, What's It Like to Be a JavaScript Developer in 2015? And this person has a really, really simple problem to solve. They just need to have data that's displayed in a table using an API call. And it's a laundry list of dependencies and technologies that are necessary in order to accomplish that goal. And that was in 2015. That was 7 years ago. So it's really just gotten worse and worse, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree with that too. Especially my time when I was working specifically for that DevSecOps company that we'd mentioned earlier, I didn't realize that so many organizations were just completely unaware of what an SBOM is. So, you know, your software bill of materials, or even the concept of transitive dependencies, of having those dependencies that are dependent on other dependencies. So yes, very much yes.
Whether you're just starting on your flight into cloud security or have been in the clouds for years, the SANS Cloud Security Flight Plan will help you find your runway and heading to progress your cloud security career. Broken down by job roles of cloud security analyst, engineer, architect, DevOps professional, and cloud security manager, this job role map helps pinpoint your starting place for training and certification, whether you're at the baseline or flying Mach 3. We are here to support your journey in cloud security. Download your copy at sansurl.com/flightplan.
Yeah, another thing we're going to have to add to the show notes is the ebook and the presentation for the Cloud Exchange event that Sans had in August, because I talk about the irresponsible, reckless inclusion of third-party code and how that can result in some very serious vulnerabilities. So hopefully people have the chance to listen to that. It's just wild to me, because now you have third-party code that's vulnerable by accident. You have third-party code that's hijacked by a third party to inject malware. And now, recently, I still can't get over this, there's a new trend where people are purposefully sabotaging their own code base.
I was going to bring that up.
This is a perfect tie-in to your time at Sneak, because Sneak is all about finding dependencies that have known vulnerabilities or other issues. So where do you think software component analysis comes into the picture?
So one of the things that whenever we talked about the software composition analysis for it, that is something that Sneak, that's where it started, just to preface, like that's where the company started in terms of like the offerings that they had. And whenever I was there, there were statistics that floated around that essentially said, hey, 80 to 90% of an organization's code is typically open source, and you have to take those transitive dependencies, like the colors one that we were mentioning, into consideration whenever you're building out any application, any website, or anything that has to do with coding within your infrastructure. So the thing that I learned is, a lot of that's true. It's all too often that it has that sort of iceberg effect. And proprietary code is what we think of whenever we think of coding. But there's all of those other things beneath the surface that we don't really think about or that we don't really consider. What are we pulling in? Are we using infrastructure as code? Are we using, we talked about like Docker and Kubernetes earlier. Are we making sure that those Docker images that we're using or that we are using are something that's safe? Is it something that's efficient? Is it something that we need? Those are a lot of the things that I came to figure out whenever I was working there and got to see firsthand some really, really great companies that knew and some that may not have known so much upfront.
Yeah, I keep hearing that statistic, and I actually cite that statistic in the episode or the event that I mentioned earlier, the Cloud Exchange 2022 event. I honestly think that statistic is on the low side. I think when you really add up all the transitive dependencies, I think it's got to be closer to 95, maybe even 99% of code, because a lot of what you're doing for your organization is just so small. It's doing one really specific thing for your business. And you're supposed to do that, right? You're supposed to depend on other codes so that you don't go outside of your core competency, right? We're not going to write our own operating system. We're not going to build our own browsers in order to support our web applications. So at a certain point, it is inevitable, but it is important to have that balance. And tying it back into the big cloud providers, when you have these packages that could be malicious, there's also well-known APIs for the cloud providers where this malicious code could now pivot within your cloud account and talk to all these well-known services that operate in a particular way. So it really just spirals out of control really quickly.
Yeah. And that's another thing, you know, I kind of went back, or I'm going to keep, you know, referencing back to earlier conversations too, because all of this ties together really well. Whenever organizations will set up, you know, any sort of cloud infrastructure, like I mentioned earlier, they're not really, I say they as if it's everyone, there's a good portion of them that don't think of security or even continuous compliance as a piece of that, or ways to monitor those different aspects. So whenever I was working at Checkpoint, for example, there was a cloud monitoring tool that they had. And this isn't an endorsement of it or anything like that. But my point is, a lot of companies don't have anything like that to continuously monitor and see where they're at from a compliance perspective. Like you could match it up against all of these different types of compliance, whether it's PCI or HIPAA or, you know, GDPR, and see if you actually, you know, met those regulatory standards. And I don't see that as something that happens very broadly.
Definitely not. And I think that a lot of people, like you said, they think about bolting on security, or they just think inherently by using the cloud, it's all secure, because they don't understand the shared responsibility model. So hopefully, if nothing else, this conversation and many of the other conversations we have at Sands Cloud Security just really hammers that in, that you can't just say the cloud is secure and then you're secure as a result.
Yeah, I like to think of it like, so I live in Oklahoma, right? And inevitably, I have foundation issues with my house. Now, I sit and think sometimes, okay, if XYZ thing were to be done differently, I probably wouldn't have this problem. If this home was built more securely, if these corners weren't cut, I probably wouldn't have to be dealing with this, right? And whenever it comes to things like that, you have to treat it. We even use architectural terms when we talk about building out infrastructure. So it's like, you have to think of it as, would you rather add these much needed pieces later on when you have to like completely tear down a wall or, you know, like redo a door frame? You want to do it from the start and you want it to be foundational. It's not going to make sense to tear into things and do it after, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm going to butcher the quote, but it's something like an hour of coding saves 10 minutes of planning or vice versa. It's some kind of joke where in reality, coding actually ends up adding more time in order to build things out properly. And the same thing is true when it comes to setting up your cloud accounts. So yeah, architecture is architecture, just in a different context.
Now, exactly.
Now I could talk about this forever, but I just gotta talk about this art cave that you're involved with. What is that all about?
Okay, so I just mentioned that I lived in Oklahoma. A while back, I was on the board of a retro gaming convention, and I still do some leadership things as far as the online group goes. But I said to myself, after we had to stop doing the convention because of a tornado that hit during one of the days, you know, we have this money left over and there's not really a lot to do in Oklahoma. And I stewed about it and I thought to myself, well, I could do something. So I decided that with the help of some friends that I wanted to create a video game art show, which like I had mentioned, or actually you mentioned, I have a degree in fine art. So whenever I talked to the other board members about it, they said, okay, this is something we can do, but we don't want it to be like the art that was at a lot of the convention spaces that we had. We don't want the pearlers, no prints, nothing like that. It has to be traditional, you know, unique pieces of art. So I was able to get a venue and I contacted a bunch of artists and did Artcade as an event. It happened, I believe, gosh, it was, I think 2017, 2018 and 2019. And then sadly, you know, womp womp, because of COVID, the pandemic. I haven't done it since. But each year, what we would do is we would pick a charity and it was completely free to attend. And we had the artists, they had to pay this really low fee to have their work, actually showcased. So, or actually, part of it went to the operational costs and then the other part went to that charity. And then we encouraged donations on site at the event as well, which was amazing. Each year we had, I think it was at least over 50% of the pieces sell and the artists got to keep 100% of the profits. And then we each year raised, I think at least, and this is me, like the hamster is spinning, I'm trying to remember. I want to say around $300 or $400 each year for the event to those charitable organizations, not including the money from the original fee for the artists. So that was just like people donating on site.
Excellent. Good cause, a lot of good fun. What were some of the pieces that were selling?
Oh gosh, there were so many. So the first year that I had it, I didn't have any themes or anything like that. So I just let people, as long as it was a video game and it was a piece of art, I let it in. And then I decided, wow, wouldn't it be really cool if we started doing some sort of thematic stuff? So the next year I did the dogs of gaming. And then the year after that, it was the women of gaming. So for that year, for example, you know, we had a lot of Samus, Lara Croft, you know, Zelda from Legend of Zelda. And for the dogs, it was like Arcanine, Rush, all different, you know, gaming doggos. But overall, it was just a mixture of different things. Even some obscure titles that I was really happy to see. One that I purchased from someone was from the game Okage. I don't know if you've heard of that. It was on PlayStation 2, I believe. So, you know, you'll get your Mario, you'll get your Legend of Zelda, you'll get your, you know, typical like God of War, things that are popularized. But then you also had some neat little nuggets in there too that you might not see anywhere else.
Very cool. And you mentioned Rush, and I think it's really funny that this is the second episode of one of the Sands podcasts where Mega Man came up. So classic. Is there like a digital gallery with some of this artwork that we could share in the footnotes or the show notes, I should say?
Yeah, I can send that to where we can have it in the reference. I do have a website that I need to transfer the domain for, yada, yada. But I will give that to you and we can put it in the show notes so people can see some of the prior pieces that were available at Oklahoma Artcade.
Excellent. Now, I personally got into development and cybersecurity partially because of my love for video games and breaking video games. Is that a thing that happened for you, or were these just separate interests in your mind?
No, I think that that's kind of for me too, because as a kid, I always liked computers. I really liked video games. And as you're mentioning, I did like to see where I could kind of like fudge things a little, or, you know, I like to break boundaries in games. So I think that those things are often intertwined for people. And whenever it came down to, am I getting into it because of video games? It's kind of it's a mixed answer. I think that helped influence it a lot, and it really helped influence my love for technology, but I wouldn't say it's directly responsible for me.
Yeah, I think at a certain point for me, that was the push, and then eventually I just wanted to keep going, and that was disconnected from that initial push. So sounds like it may be similar.
Yeah. Because I try to think back to, especially, you know, my earlier days, whenever I'd play a lot of, you know, StarCraft on Battle.net and stuff like that. And, you know, seeing people for the first time actually exploit a game, it just blew my mind whenever I'd see that in Diablo as well, where it's like, hey, wait a minute, they shouldn't be able to do that or have that item or like fly. How are they doing that? And then looking into it and figuring out, wow, this game is actually just a series of like letters and numbers strung together that have different points of reference. And they just go and, you know, it's based on triggers. So I do think, again, there's a lot of influence. And anytime I play a game, I find myself thinking, I wonder like what particular, like how that code works for this, or, you know, like how would they get it to do this specific thing? And whenever this action happens.
To tie a lot of these conversations together, I think this really goes to show that if something can be exploited, it will be exploited. And when you think about the fact that Log4j was researched through Minecraft.
Yeah, I was going to say Minecraft.
You'll see that, you know, software components that we depend on for all sorts of applications, be it video games or banking software, the same vulnerabilities can have catastrophically different impacts.
Yeah, and I like that you tied it together too, because I don't think enough people really think about that. Log4j exists on Minecraft servers, as well as, you know, inside maybe some banking applications. Like, that's how widespread and just largely used some of these things are.
Most certainly. I could talk to you about the intersection between security and video games all day, but we do have to wrap up. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about before we concluded is that part of your current role involves helping SANS customers understand which courses and resources are the best for supporting their goals. So when people come to you and ask, how do I break into the cloud? What's your answer or answers?
So it's a multifaceted answer again. I feel like I never have just a complete direct response to anything. So whenever it comes to that, typically what we will do is we kind of ask those same questions. Okay, we try to get a baseline. We try to figure out where someone is at, right? That can be done in a series of different ways. We can ask, you know, some leading questions. We can make sure that we see something like an assessment result, or we can just kind of get this, I guess, generalized idea of where their knowledge sits already. Because some people might know, even if they don't think they do, some aspects already, and some might just be completely fresh and need to just start from the beginning. My goal is, whenever it comes to making those recommendations, is ensuring that someone has the best fit for where they're at and saves them the most time and money. So if they have any prior trainings, we don't want to duplicate those results. We want to make sure that whatever they go into that, you know, is completely valid and that they will have success in taking that course.
Absolutely. And I think it's going to be a different answer for everybody. We have a whole lot of courses in the cloud curriculum. I hope people will look it up, our cloud curriculum at sans.org/cloud, like I like to shamelessly plug at the end of all of our episodes. But I really thank you for being involved in the process of helping organizations determine the courses that they need for their various employees, depending on where they're at in that stage.
Yeah. In terms of what cloud classes to start with, if you are just starting out, I say SEC. I know some people say SEC, but SEC 388 or 488, excellent places to start. If you're a little bit further along, maybe SEC 510 is good for you. If you're a developer, on the other hand, SEC 510 is also good. But if you want to know more about APIs or even securing the software development lifecycle and web application security, consider SEC 522 or SEC 540.
Wow, you really just did my job for me right there. The shameless plug role that we have at the end of many of these episodes. So I really want to take the time to thank you for attending this session. Where can we find you online? What social media do you use?
Oh, let's see. I use LinkedIn. I think my LinkedIn is /in/findstacyhere. So that one is the one that I would recommend finding me on. Otherwise, you're going to have to do a little bit of OSINT and find my Twitter all on your own, all you security professionals out there.
Or folks can just take a look at the show notes as well.
Or that. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I really, really appreciate you taking the time to join us for this episode of Sans Cloud Ace. As always, I hope that folks enjoyed the topics that we covered, and we'll take some of the advice that Stacy meant, both with regards to all the different things that you should implement within your cloud and development environment, as well as checking out some of those courses and free resources. So Stacy, really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, thank you. My parting words would be, in terms of people, processes, and technologies, understand that people is always the most important part. Have empathy, stay hydrated, and have a wonderful day.